Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, we learn this week that John McCain has suffered the loss of several of his top-ranking campaign officials in the wake of disastrously low fundraising and disastrously high spending, which has plunged his campaign into debt. And we also learned that the campaign before the mass resignations was riven by infighting among several of the top executives in the campaign who could never quite agree or get clear direction from the candidate on who was doing what job-wise and who had the final say. Fortunately, McCain is not a candidate for chief executive. And we have now, I think this week, if there is such a thing as a tipping point, I think this week was it. Because if you ever wondered about the herd instinct in among both politicians and the media, this week would have confirmed it for you. Had you seen Tony Snow's press briefing at the White House or the president's own press conference, you would have seen that the spine so absent in the Washington press corps for lo these many years has miraculously returned. Suddenly, they realize that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is not the same thing as Al-Qaeda. Suddenly, it's on the front page of the New York Times this week. That's front page news in mid-July 2007 that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is not the same thing as Al-Qaeda. Next thing you know, front page news in the New York Times, Wendy's is not the same as McDonald's. They sell burgers, we thought. And just to affirm that when they all turn, they all turn. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting open question whether it's just because this is all happening, the return of the emboldification of the press corps and the simultaneous chickenification of the Republican candidates who are running for re-election next year, whether it's just because of the polls, or in the case of the press, whether it's because the people who talk to them, the anonymous sources, are emboldened because of the perceived weakness of the president. It's all the same thing. It's just different. But to confirm, ladies and gentlemen, that they all come around when they come around, the newspaper that has made throughout the years a specialty of being last to the story, this was the newspaper that would, if it went out of business, be the last to publish that notice as well of its own demise. The Los Angeles dog trainer, today, Sunday, front pages this. Although Bush administration officials have frequently lashed out at Syria and Iran, accusing it of helping insurgents and militias in Baghdad, the largest number of foreign fighters and suicide bombers in Iraq come from Saudi Arabia, according to a senior U.S. military officer. About 45% of all foreign militants targeting U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians are from Saudi Arabia, 15% from Syria, Lebanon, 10% from North Africa. Nearly half of the foreigners in U.S. detention facilities in Iraq are Saudis. Fighters from Saudi Arabia are thought to have carried out more suicide bombings than those of any other nationality. Well, that takes care of the problem. We don't have to kill them. This is apparently the first time a U.S. official has given such a breakdown on the role played by Saudi nationals in Iraq's Sunni Arab insurgency. So, is it just the L.A. dog trainer finally waking up and calling a guy? Or is it the guy finally saying, yeah, maybe it's safe? 50% of all Saudi fighters in Iraq come as suicide bombers. The rest are confused about their role. I don't know. So, when it turns, And, of course, as hard as it was to turn it in the first place, it's probably, and don't sympathize with the administration, but this is their problem now, doubly hard to turn it back. Enjoy. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, back in the Le Show Dome, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. We might well note that Saudi Arabia was the source of most of the 9/11 participants, and that between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which the American media is also waking up to, the existence of Pakistan, that is to say, had there been the kind of reporting then about Saudi Arabia and Pakistan that we're seeing now, we might have had a little better understanding of the context in which Iraq existed and exists. But context? I'm sorry. I said a dirty word. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. There'll be an FCC fine for that. From the Sunday Telegraph in London, who knew, department? They were mop-top pop rock quartets whose millions of screaming female fans made them cultural icons of the 60s. 40 years and tens of millions of album sales later, Their catchy tunes still guarantee them a place in the hearts of music fans worldwide. But while the Beatles were among the first to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Monkees, one of the first bands manufactured to cash in on the success of the Fab Four, believe a plot is afoot to deny them their place in the rock music pantheon. In what has become a battle for the heart and soul of popular music, the Monkees claim that a move to have them included this year to mark their 40th anniversary was secretly blocked by the man who set up the Hall of Fame, Rolling Stone music publisher, Rolling Stone magazine publisher, Jan Wenner. The band believes Wenner blames it for the current influx of manufactured acts and television talent shows that have seized control of chart music. The Monkees toured with Jimi Hendrix, really, performed 200 concerts, sold 65 million records. The Hall of Fame includes two of their hits, I'm a Believer and Last Train to Clarksville, in its list of the 500 key songs that shaped rock and roll. Who knew, department? But they're best remembered for being a group specifically put together for a television series and did not play their own instruments on the two of their four albums that sold any copies. Such facts may be easily glossed over in a world now used to television pop idols and the Spice Girls, but are less easily forgotten by aficionados. Peter Tork says, "The only person holding a grudge is Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone. He has never written a gracious word. He personally has the veto power to keep us out. Everybody's forgotten it except Wenner. He's been vicious." In an interview with the Sunday Telegraph, the group's lead singer, Manchester-born Davy Jones, said, "Wenner is clearly the one who has the last say on whom the organization promotes. I wonder whether people are going to travel to Cleveland and ask, where are the Monkees?" You know, I think I've asked that question every time I've traveled to Cleveland. Jones now divides his time between owning 12 racehorses and performing in pantomime, which is not what you think. He says of Jan Wenner, "He probably did not enjoy our music when we were beginning." Probably. "I think he's trying to link us to the popularity of manufactured bands. That is not fair to us, as we did play our instruments and we were musicians. The problem was we got caught up in a promotional machine." Defending his credentials, Jones, 61-year-old Davy Jones, says, "There is no one more rock and roll than me. I still go out and party. I get through more mojitos during a night than you could imagine." So I vote him in. Right there. Just to forget. There were lots of girls back in the day and all kinds of things went on, but no one got to see that side of us. We were not such goody two-shoes, but we were made to appeal to kids, and kids that not need to hear about that kind of thing. Since news of the snub emerged, he has been inundated with messages of support. The Hall of Fame did not return calls seeking comment from Wenner, who's given no response to the allegations and has not commented on the alligators. More news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, once you get over the hurt about the Monkees. I think we should all go to Cleveland and ask, where are the Monkees? Gordon Brown, the new Prime Minister of England, should change Britain's military strategy in Iraq and withdraw British troops as soon as Iraq's own security forces are ready to take over security duties. That's according to a high-level independent report issued this weekend. Maliki says the security forces are ready now. The Iraq Commission, set up by the London-based Foreign Policy Center and television channel 4, says the troops should only remain, quote, as long as they have a job to do. Echoing the complaint last autumn of the head of the army, General Sir Richard Dannett, that the presence of British troops was exacerbating the situation in southern Iraq and that they should be withdrawn soon, the commission says the security situation is not improving in Basra, and UK forces on the streets are often a target for insurgents. Current policy has stalled, has no clear end point, and effectively cedes decision-making on withdrawal to the insurgents. It calls for a clear exit strategy. Wasn't that the Powell doc? British forces should stop offensive operations and focus on training Iraqi forces, who should take over when they're ready, regardless of the prevailing security situation. That echoes, of course, the recommendations of the Baker-Hamilton Commission in this country. These damn commissions. It's a commission conspiracy. The commission was headed by Lord Ashdown, once derided in British political circles as Paddy Pantsdown, but now he's a lord. He's the international overlord in Bosnia. Who knew? After taking evidence from dozens of witnesses and organizations, the commission concludes there are no easy options left in Iraq, only painful ones. Well, you know what I say. Double down on the painkillers. The commission urges the prime minister to launch a diplomatic offensive. It's just they basically crib the Iraq Study Group report. It's amazing. It also calls for urgent action to deal with a growing refugee crisis. Yeah. Okay, more. More news from outside the bubble. U.S. war veterans' eyewitness accounts of brutal events in the war in Iraq have been published in a liberal U.S. magazine, The Nation, devoted its entire July 30th edition to the testimony of 50 U.S. troops shocked by the heavy civilian casualty toll during the occupation. Quote, just the carnage, all the blown-up civilians, blown-up bodies that I saw, I started thinking, like, why? What was this for? Says Army Specialist Jeff Engelhardt. The Nation magazine says the first time so many on-the-record named eyewitnesses from within the U.S. military have been assembled in one place to openly corroborate a brutal side of the war rarely seen on TV screens or chronicled in newspaper accounts. Only the L.A. dog trainer has picked up on the Nation story, which on Saturday continued to go unreported by the country's main TV stations and newspapers. This is a report in the British newspaper, The Independent. Many of these veterans returned home deeply disturbed by the disparity between the reality of the war and the way it's portrayed by the U.S. government and American media, says the magazine. The witnesses stressed not all troops took part in indiscriminate killings, which were mostly, quote, perpetrated by a minority. Those bad apples. The soldiers, quote, nevertheless described such acts as common and said they often go unreported and almost always go unpunished. The war that, continuing the magazine, the war the vets described as a dark and even depraved enterprise, one that bears a powerful resemblance to other misguided and brutal colonial wars and occupations, said Engelhardt, who served in Bakuba for a year. I guess while I was there, the general attitude was, a dead Iraqi is just another dead Iraqi. This report from Agence France-Presse, actually. More news from outside the bubble. Not as depressing.
Well,
Australian drinking water standards are under scrutiny after scientific research linking commonly used herbicides to gender bending in male frogs. This is noteworthy to me mainly because the fashion police are now saying, well, actually the eco-fashion police are now saying, knock off the bottled water. And restaurants in trendy precincts of California and New York are now serving tap water, you see. Back to the story. The National Health and Medical Research Council is reassessing its drinking water guidelines in Australia after minuscule traces of the herbicides atrazine and simazine. You remember them? They used to be the double mint twins. Now they're herbicides. Were found to turn the frogs into hermaphrodites, creatures with male and female sex organs. Australian guidelines allow up to 40 parts per billion of atrazine in drinking water. Scientific studies have found that male frogs grow ovaries when exposed to the chemical at the minuscule level of one part per billion in water. So, maybe those restaurants might want to make sure at least that they don't serve to frogs. Atrazine was banned in the European Union 4 years ago, but it's been used for weed control in Australia for more than 25 years. And is the nation's second most commonly used agricultural pesticide. There is no legal requirement for atrazine users in Australia to notify water authorities when the chemical is being sprayed. And Melbourne Water tests for atrazine but does not test for simazine, which is used on vineyards in the Yarra Valley. That's good wine. What struck us as unbelievable was that atrazine could cause such dramatic effects at such low levels, says Dr. Tyrone Hayes, an associate professor of integrative biology at UC Berkeley, who led the frog study. More. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. has no hard evidence that the Sunni Muslim insurgent group Al-Qaeda in Iraq was responsible for the recent bombing of a Shiite shrine in Samarra. But wait a minute, I thought Bush administration cite the attack as proof that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is stoking sectarian violence. But McClatchy newspapers In an interview with Gates, reports him saying, "It seems to me that's probably an analytical conclusion about al-Qaeda in Iraq. I'm not sure whether they have a lot of hard evidence about it." Well, why not base your analysis on a lack of evidence? That way you can have a higher level of certainty. More. British troops serving in Iraq are being killed at a proportionally greater rate than their American allies for the first time since the start of the war. This watershed has led to calls for the government to set an immediate timetable for withdrawal from the war-torn country. One of the Army's most senior commanders told the Sunday Telegraph in London that the war in Iraq was now regarded by political and military chiefs within the Ministry of Defense of our ally Great Britain as, quote, a lost cause, unquote. Those tea-drinking defeatists. The officer added that Britain and America had to accept that they were facing the possibility of, quote, strategic failure, unquote, in Iraq. We have to face that possibility, ladies and gentlemen, according to the Brits, in 2007. It's now widely accepted in the higher echelons of the military that the Prime Minister will ask the Chief of the Defense Staff to start withdrawing British troops by spring of next year. And finally, news from outside the bubble. I know, it should be more cheerful, shouldn't it? A senior American Army officer in Afghanistan says that only about 40% of the Afghan police force is properly equipped, according to BBC News. But he said resources are now in place to solve the problem. While the Army is relatively well-equipped and trained, says Major General Robert Durbin, only 40% of the police force is properly equipped. He says that's because until 18 months ago, the international community had provided almost $2 billion for reforming the Army, but less than a tenth of that in the police force. Last year, a U.S. government report concluded the Afghan police were largely incapable of carrying out their law enforcement responsibilities because of corruption, illiteracy, low pay, bad equipment, the insurgency, and insufficient training. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, they're a fine force. Many Afghans said they have lost confidence in the force, alleging that many policemen top up their pay with bribes from petty criminals or from drug smugglers. Afghans have accused the police of rampant corruption and being involved in extortion, kidnapping, and robbery. Nice people doing nice things wherever you look. Ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And also from McClatchy. A State Department official, after initially denying that state had ordered its 1,000 Baghdad personnel to wear protective gear, says that the order calling for a flak vest and Kevlar to be worn inside the green zone was because it got leaked to McClatchy, an undiscussable security breach. The embassy issued the memo after Saturday, a barrage of 35 mortars and rockets slammed into the green zone on Wednesday. The green zone, of course, the safest place in Baghdad. As a result of the recent increase of indirect fire attacks on the international zone, outdoor movement is restricted to a minimum, says the memo. Remain within a hardened structure to the maximum extent possible and strictly avoid congregating outdoors. Personal protective equipment, PPE, is mandatory until further notice. Public places that are not in a hardened structure, such as the Blue Star Restaurant in the green zone, green and blue make, should be frequented only in conjunction with the use of your PPE. Embassy spokesman initially denied the state now requires workers to wear body armor in the green zone. He got upset when shown the memo. He refused to give his name, asked how they got the memo, and said, "We don't talk about what our security posture is." Now, we're being told by the White House that although things are kind of scratchy in other provinces of Iraq, like Diyala, things are cooler. Things are getting actually close to normal in Baghdad. So the State Department is requiring its own people inside the green zone to wear body armor and not to go outside in the green zone. asked how state could require workers to walk around outdoors in body armor while making them sleep in unprotected quarters, the embassy official said, quote, I wouldn't characterize it as being a mixed message. State Department personnel sleep unprotected, while British and United Nations personnel in the green zone sleep in hardened housing. U.S. Embassy workers, speaking on condition of anonymity, have told McClatchy that they're angry and scared about that situation. They will get hardened sleeping quarters when the new American embassy is complete this fall. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Make your travel plans now. This is Le Show, and talk about living in a dream world. President Nixon, in his 1972 re-election campaign, tried to tie the Democrats to the mob, gay liberation, and even slavery, according to newly released papers and tapes from the Nixon Library. Now trying to be real. Still, as Nixon's lieutenants explored every avenue for defeating George McGovern and nullifying critics of all stripes, the president brooded over his reputation as a hard man whose gentle side was not being seen by the public. Nixon called that side of him the whole warmth business. In 1970, he wrote an 11-page, single-spaced memo detailing his acts of kindness to staff and strangers and expressing regret that he was getting no credit for being, quote, nicey-nice, unquote. That's so tragic to me, because the irony is, and of course it's too late now, but that's always how I saw Nixon. Nicey-nice. That's it. That's it in a nutshell, which, by the way, is where it belongs. Ladies and gentlemen, last weekend, the host of this broadcast was in London, England, as you may well know, part of that fake rock band, Spinal Tap, appearing at Live Earth, along with a lot of real rock bands. It's just so hard to tell, though. Both ways. And you probably read or heard a lot of talk about the event, both leading up to it and in the aftermath. There's been, of course, no shortage of criticism of the worldwide series of concerts, which were convened, I think would be the word, by Al Gore to try to raise global consciousness about the climate change deal, the whole warmth business, as Richard Nixon would have put it. And some of the criticisms have centered around the expenditure of money and energy to fly entertainers to the various venues. Spinal Tap flew to London, even though they're not real. It was a real. They flew in a real plane. Explain that. Some of the other critics have said, well, the bands basically just sort of ignored the message and nattered on about their own stuff. Or if they did talk on message, it was, you know, it was rock people talking. In a more quantitative way, NBC, which carried a 3-hour primetime clip job, is that fair to say? Clip job of the worldwide series of concerts in primetime last Saturday night, finished number 4 among the, I believe, 5 networks. 4 out of 5. That's good when it's doctors, but it's not good when it's ratings. And even Microsoft, which carried the concerts on its MSN broadband network on the internet, said they broke the record for online streaming. But they later issued a clarification that they're going to issue a patch for that number. So we have to wait on that. So the criticism, I guess, is that it didn't have an effect and it was wasteful, and it was even Sir Bob Geldof, before the event took place, was criticizing it, saying, well, everybody knows about global warming. You got to get them to do something about it. This is, of course, the guy who will go down in posterity as the guy who made poverty history. He just did it. There's no poor people anymore because of Live 8. Isn't that right? So didn't do anything, didn't get any numbers, wasted carbon. That's the criticism of Live Earth. Former Vice President Gore has taken these criticisms to heart. We understand that he has organized a new event with a lot less publicity. It's going on this weekend. We have negotiated and received excerpt rights for it, and I'm getting a signal that in a couple minutes we'll be ready to join it. It's in progress, but they're doing their own stuff. We'll be ready to kind of listen in on it. So that's moments away here on the show.
Mr. Jesse, you sure got some fine barbecue. Hey, Mr. Jesse, you sure got some fine barbecue. Hey, Mr. Jesse, you sure got some fine barbecue. I'll be around to get some tonight about a quarter to two. I don't want it too hot, I don't want it too cold. I'm gonna eat the meat right down to the bone. I don't want it too fat, I don't want it too lean. Hey there, Jesse, you know what I mean. Hey, Mr. Jesse, you sure got some fine barbecue. I'll be around to get some tonight about a quarter to two. Jesse's shop really starts to rock. The band is playing that low-down blues, and you can get any kind of meat you choose. That two joints jumping all night long. That Kansas City barbecue, man, it's really gone. Some like it light, I love it dark brown. He got the finest pork chops in this man's town. Hey, Mr. Jesse, you sure got some fine barbecue. I'll be around to get some tonight about a quarter to two.
All right, we go there live right now.
All right, I have to say, welcome back to Live Al. Those who are joining us late in the proceedings, just a brief conspectus of what we're doing here today at beautiful Mohegan Sun Stadium. We had a lot of criticism about our last event, that it was too carbon expensive and too unfocused, too many rock stars with their own agendas. And of course, we appreciate the efforts and the goodwill of all those performers. But tonight, we're doing something a little bit different, a little more carbon friendly, and a little more focused. Live Al is me, just me, and just a few friends, and I guess since Al Franken can run for political office, I can tell some jokes. Of course, now that he's running for office, I'm writing jokes for him. But Al Franken will be with us via carbon-neutral satellite from the Twin Cities in the next hour. Al, what do you have coming up for us?
Pretty much more of what you're doing, Al.
Well, looking forward to that. And one of the things we are doing, in fact, the only thing, is getting the message across every which way we can. And one way we can is with music.
Can you feel it? Can you hear it? Can I see the words a little more clearly on the prompter there? Thank you.
Save the darter, save the snail, save the head, and save the tail. Save it all or go to jail. Save it all. Save it all. Save the turtle. Save the squid. Save the gentle Katie did. Save the goat and save the kid. Save it all. Save it all. Save it all. You don't know which part you're gonna need. Save it all. Save the oak, just about to fall. Save that scrumptious butterball. Save the big things and save the small. Oh, save it all. Yeah, save it all. Put your hands together, take them apart, put them together again, and keep doing it rhythmically like our brothers and sisters do. Change your light bulbs, oh, change your socks, lose the tote bag, lose the cardboard box, change your life, and change your locks. Change it all. Change it all. Change your eating. Change your oil. Change the water that you boil. Change to hemp for that cooking foil. Change it all. Change it all. Change it all. Your life's just one big carbon plant. Change it all and make this song into a chant. Don't say you can't change consumption. Change your clothes. Suck your emissions back through a hose. We'd like to thank the folks at Bose. They gave us our audio equipment systems. Change it all. Oh, change it all. One more thing. Change your savings. Save your change. Even though it may feel quite strange, be the key to rearrange. Rent a hall, have a ball. We must run before we crawl. Prevent the pall, make that call. Of course, we're not taking calls, but save it all. Thank you very much.
We may try to get back to a Live Al. On the other hand, we may not.
Honey, where the money gone? Where the money go? I've been working two jobs, baby. Bring you all my dough. Now they say you got another man and you leave me right away. What happened to all that cash been keeping for a rainy day? Well, there's one thing, one thing, one thing I wanna know. I don't care where the loving went. Baby, where did the money go? Can't move around this old house, catalogs and shopping bags. Meanwhile, they repossess the only car I ever had. Took away my TV set and canceled my credit brand. Can't find those dollar bills I've been keeping in the coffee can. Well, there's one thing that I wanna know. I don't care where the loving went, baby, but honey, where did the money go? Where the money go?
Where the money go?
Where the money go?
Where the money go?
I wanna know, honey, where did the money go? Baby, you look so good in your brand new dress. I wonder how you paid for that. Now you just let me guess. Now you say you're moving on, hitting where the living is fine. How come I get the feeling that it cost me my last dime?
Well, there's
one thing I really wanna know. I don't care where the loving went, baby, but honey, where did the money go? I don't care where the loving went, baby, but honey, where did the money go? I don't care where the loving went, honey, tell me where did the money go?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. What Dixon used to call the old whole warmth business.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Deadline Funafuti, Tuvalu. The beaches are vanishing. The crops that used to grow are poisoned by salt water. Tuvalu is a string of nine picturesque atolls and coral islands. Global warming is not an abstract danger there. It's a daily reality. This is according to the Gulf Times. The tiny South Pacific nation, only 4 meters above sea level at its highest point, may not exist in a few decades. Its people are already in flight. More than 4,000 have gone to New Zealand. Many of the remaining 10,500 are planning to join the exodus. Others, though, are determined to stay and try to fight the advancing waves. The outlook is bleak. A tidal gauge on the main atoll, Funafuti, suggests the sea level is climbing by 5.6 millimeters a year, twice the average global rate predicted by the UN's International Panel on Climate Change. That figure may be alarming, implying a rise of more than half a meter in the next century. Most Tuvaluans live just 1 to 2 meters above sea level. The main prominence of Tuvalu is that they own the domain, the internet domain TV. So everybody who's got .tv as their domain name should either celebrate or worry. Wild salmon should be leaping upstream in Britain now as they undertake one of nature's great journeys, completing their trek from the Atlantic Ocean to return to the Scottish rivers in which they were spawned. But this year's summer run is worryingly late, according to the British Sunday Telegraph, and causing concern among anglers. It comes amid growing fears for the future of the species, whose numbers returning to Scottish waters have been cut in half since the 1970s. Sounds like Seattle. Catches on the big four salmon rivers are already significantly down on previous years, and there are fears that the delays of up to 4 weeks in the summer run will further damage the stocks. There's also increasing concern about the size and fertility of the returning fish. The average weight of a young salmon or grills. Grills is a one-year-old fish, has dropped by 15% in the past decade. Egg production has dropped by 15%. Researchers believe this is because the salmon's ocean food sources of krill and shrimp, which thrive in deep cold waters, are declining due to rising sea temperatures. At the same time, the industry is bracing itself for the arrival of a fish bug from Scandinavia, which threatens to decimate the salmon population. The 70-million-pound, $140 million salmon fishing business is centered on four main rivers, the Tay, the Dee, the Spey, and the Tweed. I just wanted to read those rivers' names for you. A Queensland, Australia professor says the farm agriculture sector of Australia needs to be ready for increasing numbers of parasites as a result of climate change. Professor Peter O'Donoghue from the University of Queensland says global warming will expand the areas where parasites can live, hurting agricultural production. He says as parasites spread, the severity of diseases will also increase. We'll have a lot more susceptible hosts suddenly being exposed to diseases for the first time, he says. Well, then I won't be your host. Direct satellite measurements of solar activity show it's been declining since the mid-1980s and therefore cannot account for recent rises in global temperatures, according to new research. The findings debunk an explanation for climate change that's often cited by people who are not convinced that greenhouse gas emissions from human activities are causing the Earth's climate to warm. If you change the output of the sun, you will undoubtedly change the climate. It's just a matter of how much, says Mike Lockwood of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in the UK. Skeptics commonly point to climate research reliance on computer models as a reason for doubting the link between global warming and greenhouse gas. We decided to do a simple and direct analysis of the potential role of the sun in recent climate change without using any model output, says Lockwood. Looking at the data for the past 40 years, he and his aides have noticed that solar activity did what Lockwood describes as a U-turn in every possible way in the mid-1980s. Somewhere between 1985 and 87, all the solar factors that could have affected climate change have been going in the wrong direction. If they were really a big factor, we would have cooling by now. Lockwood adds he wishes he knew why the sun's activity had changed in this way. I do too. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It's so copyrighted. It copyrights itself. A New Orleans woman who sued those who sold FEMA motorhomes over formaldehyde exposure in the FEMA trailers has died of lung cancer. F is for FEMA. The lawsuit alleges thousands of hurricane victims who lived in the trailers have been exposed to dangerously high concentrations of formaldehyde fumes and have had no choice but to accept their plight. And thousands of pounds of ice originally sent to Hurricane Katrina relief efforts are being melted after being stored in Gloucester, Massachusetts for 2 years. They weren't given away to the people who needed it. They've been kept frozen in Massachusetts. Well, that doesn't cost any energy. A FEMA spokeswoman told the Gloucester Daily Times that the ice at Gloucester and 22 similar facilities nationwide is being melted to dispose of it for health reasons. The cost of storing the ice at all the facilities since Katrina is $12.5 million, according to the Boston Globe. The ice was originally sent south to help Katrina victims, but a few days later it was sent back north by the federal government, meaning FEMA. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers acknowledged at the time that it had ordered too much ice due to faulty estimates by local officials. Truckers received up to $900 a day to move the ice. FEMA contracts required disposal of the ice 3 months after purchase, but the agency decided to keep the excess ice for last year's hurricane season. With fewer storms than expected, the ice was not needed, and the agency decided not to save the ice for this season because it couldn't determine if the ice was safe for human consumption. Yeah, there's no way to do that. And quickly now, the apologies of the week. I wish science could figure out a way to find out if ice is healthy. The BBC has apologized to Queen Elizabeth for mistakenly showing footage that wrongly implied she walked out of a portrait session during a documentary. The program trailer showed the Queen in an exchange with photographer Annie Leibovitz, followed by a clip of her apparently walking off. The footage was not intended to be seen and was shown in error, said the BBC. The BBC would like to apologize to both the Queen and Annie Leibovitz for any upset this may have caused. The film had been edited out of sequence and supplied to the corporation by the producers in error. And of course, Louisiana Senator David Vitter sent an email to supporters earlier this week saying, quote, "I deeply apologize again for letting you and others down. Our family will be fine, though we certainly appreciate your continuing thoughts and prayers." This is just a few hours after the so-called D.C. madam posted her clients' phone numbers on the internet. He was one of the clients. "This was a very serious sin in my past for which I am, of course, completely responsible. I certainly offer my sincere and deep apologies to all I have disappointed and let down in any way." Of course, national coverage has ignored the fact that in addition to the D.C. madam, a madam and now a former prostitute in New Orleans have come out and told the Times-Picayune down there that he was a frequent client. He has not yet apologized for that. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. I'm going to skip Japan this week just because I don't remember what it's called. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio in the continental United States. Around the world by the internet and on your computer at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Free download at www.audible.com/theshow and a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like having a way to find out if ice is healthy for you, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is available through harryshearer.com. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlists are also available at the slowly reviving harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. It originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.